Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, advancing healthcare that works for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.
From Valley Public Radio, you're listening to Valley Edition. I'm your host, Kathleen Schock. Today on our show, we're looking at some of the bigger problems our Valley faces and ways to solve them, from chronic absenteeism in our school districts to human trafficking. But first, we're going to tell you about a solution aimed at one of California's most pressing problems, homelessness. There's a pilot project going on across the state, including in Kings and Kern counties, that saves taxpayer money by housing the most vulnerable homeless people. It's called Whole Person Care, and it focuses on people who cycle from the street to the ER and back again. From the California Dream Collaboration, KPCC's Matt Tinoco looks at how the program is working in a much bigger landscape, Los Angeles.
Ebony Palmer is finally beginning to calm down.
The paranoia went down tremendously.
Though she's only 25, she's already spent years homeless. About a year ago, she became one of the lucky ones who the LA homeless service system matched with housing. It's the first time she's felt secure in a long time.
Like, when I moved here, I had them change the windows because I thought someone was going to come in and get me.
The byproduct of a traumatic time spent living in hotel rooms, her car, and on friends' floors. She was a foster child, and she grew up in South LA. She fell into prostitution, which was her main mode of survival during her teens and early 20s. Now, she lives in a two-bedroom unit in a dingy mid-century apartment building in Pomona. Her two kids are there, too. It was when she became pregnant with her second child that she realized she needed to change her situation.
My main focus was this, where is this baby gonna live?
She knew she couldn't raise her in a hotel room, so she started looking for help.
There's gotta be something for pregnant and homeless. Former foster youth, like there has to be.
She got a case manager and was matched to a county program called Housing for Health. It's a public intervention that covers rent for people who are or could quickly become the so-called high utilizers, those who cycle endlessly through the medical and justice systems. It's the LA vanguard of the state's Whole Person Care pilot program, which does similar things in more than two dozen California counties. So she has stable housing now, as do her two children, who would have likely wound up in county custody if she kept on being homeless.
Yes, we got someone off the street, so they're safer. But we've also provided an environment where those children can develop to the highest potential possible.
John Backus is the CEO of LA Care, the managed Medi-Cal program in Los Angeles County. LA Care provides millions of dollars for Housing for Health. The core problem is that there's little to keep the very poorest Californians who can't keep up with the cost of living from falling down to the street. This is Sarah Mayen, who works for Housing for Health.
It sort of seems like the homeless system becomes the safety net of last resort.
Housing for Health is part of that system and an attempt to make up for decades of cuts to the American social safety net. It provides housing assistance for about 11,000 people. And that provides something else. A steady mailing address so that the formerly homeless can consistently access what's left of that safety net. The biggest sell is how it saves taxpayer money. This is Libby Boyce, Housing for Health's program director.
When somebody's really vulnerable living out on the street, they are costing a lot of money just by visits to the ER, ambulance rides, police interventions.
Like Ebony. She says she'd gone to jail at least six times for prostitution and was on the cusp of becoming chronically homeless.
For that person, it is cheaper to help them.
A study by the RAND Corporation of LA's Housing for Health program specifically found that for every dollar invested in the program, LA County saved $1.20. It costs less to cover someone's rent than it is to pay for their medical bills while they deteriorate on the street outside. The biggest challenge, though, is just the supply of cheap housing in California is largely non-existent. Even if you have a voucher, it's very hard to find somewhere to use it. Here's LA Care's Backus again.
But right now, we're not helping on the supply side. We're doing a little bit on the demand side.
Ebony doesn't have to worry about that anymore. Instead, she can focus on her baby daughter, Zuri, and she's got big plans for her upcoming birthday.
Because now I have a budget, and I've been saving, and I've been planning. So now I'm able to do that, give her her first birthday party, and I'm really proud of myself.
She says it's her first year in many of not being homeless. From Los Angeles, I'm Matt Tinoco.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Now we're going to turn to the topic of chronic absenteeism, which plagues most school districts in the Valley. We know that students who can't make it to school miss out on learning, and research shows that missing even 3 days a month over time can put students a year behind their peers. Yesterday, the Fresno County Office of Education hosted a conference looking at ways to reduce chronic absenteeism. FM89's Laura Satsui sat down with the keynote speaker, Hetty Chang. She's the founder and director of San Francisco-based Attendance Works.
Chronic absence is missing so much school for any reason, excused, unexcused suspensions, that a child falls behind because they missed out on the instruction in the classroom and the learning experiences in the classroom. We define it as missing 10% or more of the school year, which is 18 days over the school year, but we really want it to be used as an early warning so that you notice when a child missed just 2 days the first month, 4 days the second month, 6 days, because how you address chronic absence is you notice it early, figure out what might be pushing a kid out of school or creating a barrier for them getting into school, so then you can resolve that issue and get them into class before they lose so much instruction that now it's much more costly to be able to get them up to speed.
Usually, maybe what is the problem that you notice for why students aren't there?
So we think it's helpful to think about the reasons for absence as falling into four buckets. And those buckets are barriers. So those are things like no transportation or unreliable transportation, unstable housing, lack of access to health care. The second bucket, I would say, are things that are negative school experiences. The discipline policy, the suspension policy is negative. The child has a disability and there aren't the supports. The third bucket, I would say, is lack of an engaging, relevant school experience. So you don't see how is going to school going to get me to that better job? Or let's say kids don't feel a sense of connection and belonging to other students, so they don't feel engaged and part of that school experience. The last one are misconceptions. Families don't understand often that just missing 2 days a month can add up to too much, and it's not just the unexcused absences. Especially for our youngest kids, there folks don't understand how learning is what I would call scaffolded. It builds over time, so they'd understand the consequences of missed absences. But what I would also say is you got to unpack these barriers, and you got to know them at a kid, school, and a district level.
And so by one data point I found, you know, Fresno County Office of Ed schools, there's maybe up to 30% of kids that are that could be considered chronically absent. And for educators who came here to learn more about how to address it, how to take care of it, and considering all of the buckets that for reasons why students might be absent, where should educators start for coming up with solutions?
Well, and I want to, for Fresno County Office of Ed schools, those are usually continuation schools. They're usually working, serving a population of students for whom the regular ed system hasn't worked ideally. So the good news is that often you can have more tailored solutions because that's what that's designed to. I would say there's a couple things. One is, if you know you have that high level of chronic absence, you know this is going to be something that you're going to have to really build into all your work with kids in that system. I think you should be asking about absences, and because they probably had absences in their prior school, and they're having those challenges that they're getting. So in your outreach to families and to students, what would make you want to come to our school? What engages you? This isn't always a question of, so what we know is kids come to school when you have positive conditions for learning. When kids feel emotionally healthy and safe, right? Mostly and physically healthy and safe. When kids feel a sense of belonging, connection, and support, when they feel academically engaged and supported, and when they feel that the adults and the kids around them will support them. When you have high levels of chronic absence, 30% is very high, it means those conditions aren't quite in place. So I think you want to start by checking in. Do they have health issues? What would make them feel connected?
And when you mentioned, you know, you hope that teachers can identify it's not just missing 18 days in a row, but it's missing 2 days a month or you know, here and there. For those students that are just missing here and there or even a chunk of school at one time, is there any coming back from, you know, being absent and then catching up with their peers?
Absolutely. And what I think we see is you need, it's a public health model where you start with prevention and early intervention. So we actually think about bands of attendance. So satisfactory attendance is kids missing less than 5%, less than 9 days. You can miss, if you just miss a couple days, it's okay. Kids get sick and we all forget. So I'm not worried about every single, let's not go overboard here. And if you are really sick and you have a contagious disease, I do want you to stay home because coming to school does not help us, right? But if you've missed school, certainly you should help make sure that we know what you missed, and then people can help you make up if that's something you need some support with. And kids can, and families, by the way, can also turn to their peers. Sometimes it's the other kid who was in class that can best help you make up. There's this less than 5%, you're missing less than 5%, where I think there's not a whole lot you need to do. Maybe you encourage kids to just figure out what they missed when they missed class and how are they going to, you know, make up for it. Then there's a group of kids that miss between 5 and 10%, and they're starting to edge towards chronic absence. And you may want to pay attention to that. And that may be something about just identifying. So, for example, we know that if there's a barrier, like let's say there's a lot of food insecurity and kids, and this is a bigger and bigger issue, that having free breakfast in the classroom can actually help. Creating walking school buses. So you look for, at this level, because these are universal supports, things a lot of kids need because they're common barriers. Or getting, we know of a place in Texas where the issue was kids weren't getting their flu immunizations, and then they had, when the flu seasons came by, everyone like got sick. So they did a huge on-site, on-school flu immunization campaign. Those are those kind of common barriers, and you're creating a universal support that all kids can access, and that's going to help. So there's a lot of stuff that's easy communications. So that's tier one. Tier two is more earlier intervening and connecting, and it's really about a personalized relationship. So it's things like there's a proven program from New York City, which is Success Mentors. If a kid was chronically absent last year, you tie them with some person in the school who can just greet them 3 to 5 days a week to say, hey, so glad you're here. And if they see them starting to miss school, they ask them what's going on. And that relationship can maybe allow that teacher to know the issue. I know, for example, of a school, an example where they had a success mentor connecting to a kid. They realized that the day the kid almost always missed was Fridays. And Fridays was when his dad was home. And so he was skipping school to be with dad. Now, once you know that, they said, okay, we ought to incentivize dad to come to school and we'll put in that kind of place. And then there's the tier three kids, which I think are missing 20% or more school. They're missing a lot of school. That's a coordinated system with your homeless shelters, with your child welfare system, juvenile justice system. Then it's an intensive set of supports. And what we need to do is invest more in prevention and early intervention so that we don't overwhelm the system that is there for the kids who really have intensive needs.
And is this problem getting better or is it getting worse overall?
So we didn't start monitoring chronic absence till 3 years ago in California. So what I do know, though, if you look at the data for the last 3 years, as a state data on California's chronic absence rates, it's slightly getting worse. I think there's a lot of things that are challenging that. Certainly one contributing factor was the teacher strikes, which at least hopefully there won't be more, so you won't have that same issue, but you'll still have to worry about the consequences for the you know, lost instructional time. But I don't think teacher strikes explain it fully. We also have a lot of housing insecurity here in California with the rising cost of living. We also have, I think, fears. The ICE raids, the anti-immigrant sentiment does certainly create fears. So schools can reduce it. So we were just in this forum where, for example, Parlier was talking about what it's done. And they've decreased chronic absence district-wide, and they've decreased it most significantly for the kids who are homeless and disabilities. And this is over the same period that it's increasing for California. That's because they put in a tier, this prevention, early intervention. They also have a school-based health clinic, and they really approach it from a positive problem-solving approach where they partner with families to figure out what they need and engage them and get them back to school. And so I know that it can be improved, but we don't have the systems, for example, that are like in what's in Parlier. They are not everywhere. And we've just started getting this data out there. People are accustomed to a more truancy approach system. And my fear is that people don't understand this is a new way. They just look at unexcused absence. They think it's a court strategy, when this is really about a whole school working together to make school as engaging and warm and positive as possible, and then using their data to reach out and support and problem solve when kids are missing too much school.
You know, you're here in Fresno for this conference specifically. I mean, what do you hope folks are taking away today and taking to their home schools throughout the county?
What I hope they will walk away is chronic absence is a significant issue that we all have to look at if we want kids to achieve. And it is a problem that we can reduce. We can make a difference when we use our data, combine it with positive problem-solving, relationship building, and bringing in strategic partners when the challenges that are facing kids and families are beyond the reach of just schools alone to address.
All right. Well, Hetty Chang, thank you so much for talking with us about this really important topic.
My pleasure.
This is Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. California is one of the nation's top states for human trafficking, a complex crime that is difficult to combat. But here in the Valley, nonprofits are working with law enforcement to tackle the issue from multiple perspectives. I spoke with Sarah Johnson from the Fresno Economic Opportunities Commission and Jessica Pittman from the Central Valley Justice Coalition about the work taking place to end this widespread problem. So, Jessica, give us a sense of the scope of the problem in the Central Valley. I mean, my understanding is that Fresno is considered to be a hub of human trafficking. I'm wondering, why is that?
Yeah, so when we teach our human trafficking 101 classes, we ask that same question to the audience, and we go over a few of the reasons that make Fresno a place where human trafficking happens. Geographically, we're located in between some major, major world cities. We're on some major highways, of course, the 41, the 99. And we're really like a good stopping point between LA, Vegas, San Francisco. We also share that California, as a state, is actually the fifth largest economy in the entire world. And so what that means is if we were our own country, we would be the fifth richest country. And so there's just a lot of money going in and out of our state. Fresno's right in the middle of all of it. There's some other reasons, too. I mean, Fresno has some of like the highest concentrated poverty in the nation. I believe it's second highest now. So those are a few of the reasons. I know Sarah and their organization has some great specific numbers that I'll let her share that they've been tracking for years now.
Yeah, sure. So the Central Valley Against Human Trafficking Project at Fresno Economic Opportunity Commission has been around for a decade now. And so we've been collecting some data on just the clients that we have been seeing. And so since 2009, we've identified over 1,000 victims of trafficking throughout the Central Valley.
That's staggering.
The increase of victims that we've seen over the past 5 years can be due to funding, that we're doing more work within the community, we're expanding our scope because we take a really regional approach to this issue. But it also has to do with the fact that we're just seeing a lot of it. People are recognizing the signs of it now, picking up on it, and identifying it as an issue.
So give us a sense of what human trafficking looks like. Maybe start with sex trafficking and then talk about labor trafficking.
Sure, yeah. So there are two separate types of trafficking. And so the federal definition goes into the action means and the purpose of trafficking. And so the action being the recruitment, harboring, transporting, or obtaining of a person by the means of force, fraud, or coercion for the purpose of sexual services or labor. And so when we're talking about sex trafficking, there is one exception within that federal definition, is that minors, you do not need that means of force, fraud, or coercion because minors technically can't consent. So any minor involved in a commercial sex act, we do consider that human trafficking. And we see a lot of sex trafficking happening within prostitution. And so whether that is street prostitution, whether that is through online mechanisms of purchasing individuals online for sexual acts, it can also be someone being held in a home as a sexual slave for that individual. And so I think that sex trafficking in particular, we see that very often. And it is a hidden crime, but you know, the media shows us certain things and people are able to pick up on it a little bit more.
So, Jessica, I'm sorry, did you want to jump in?
Oh, yeah. I was just going to mention, kind of piggyback on what Sarah's saying, is that because sex trafficking is a lot more visible, one of the other things we talk about in our classes is how labor trafficking is absolutely prevalent as well, not just in our community, but globally. We know the numbers are far greater for labor trafficking than for sex trafficking, but it just tends to be even harder to identify.
Right. And it can happen within so many different industries, and it looks different mm-hmm. in each industry mm-hmm. that it can be a lot more difficult to identify. So whether that is an individual that's being trafficked for domestic servitude, that's living in a house as a servant, is going to look very different than an individual that's being trafficked in an agricultural industry. But it really can happen within any industry. You just the easiest way I explain it to people is you take that component of sex trafficking and you replace the sex with any kind of work. Mm-hmm. And whatever that work is, that is labor. That is labor trafficking.
So you can imagine that makes it that much harder, because instead of seeing one you can identify as potentially what we would oftentimes call a prostitution or something like that, it's just a person working a normal job, like at a restaurant or at a nail salon or any of those things. And so it's just much more complicated to identify the signs when you're talking about that.
So let's talk about the people who are committing these crimes. I mean, to what extent are gangs driving this activity, or who is purchasing people for the purposes of labor?
For labor in particular, it can look very different. So for individuals that are victims of labor trafficking, we see a really high number of foreign nationals being victimized. And for foreign nationals in particular, a lot of times their recruiters and the individuals that are trafficking them can be of their same nationality, because that's somebody that you're supposed to be trusting, right? And so they'll get recruited from their home country quite often, be told that they have this job here and that they will get paid a certain amount, and then they come, they incur debt because they're having to pay someone to get them here, and then they're told to work in an environment that they weren't promised that work in, and oftentimes they're abused both physically and sexually, and then they're working to pay off that debt, and that debt serves as a means to keep them captive.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Jessica, did you want to follow up on that?
You know, when you mentioned gangs, and I think that's definitely something to be aware of in our community, but in a lot of communities. And so I know if we had law enforcement here who we work with very closely, they would share many stories about the gang-related crimes in Fresno and how it does connect to human trafficking, specifically sex trafficking. But I also want to mention that we share oftentimes that there is kind of the myth of a certain stereotype of the people who do the crimes. And it's really kind of important, I believe, to understand that when we're talking about people who are doing committing the crime of trafficking, oftentimes we try to help people realize as those people were growing up, many times they were also abused or had other circumstances in their own lives that prepared them for what they ended up doing now. And so it's a really, really complex issue, but I just wanted to mention that there's really no one size all fits the mold, you know, for this kind of thing. And so just to be aware of that, and that, you know, we want to make wise choices. And when we look at other people, kind of think a little deeper than what we see on the surface. And that's what we, I think, are all trying to do in the field, is making sure we're looking beneath those immediate signs, but at the same time, recognizing the ones that are very clear.
You're listening to Valley Edition. We're talking with Sarah Johnson from Fresno EOC and Jessica Pittman from the Central Valley Justice Coalition about human trafficking. I'd like to focus now, the last part of our conversation, on the work that you're doing to help people escape and recover from these crimes. I understand there's a lot of work that individual organizations are doing, obviously, but they're also doing that work collaboratively. So, Sarah, maybe you could talk a little bit about your work to bring all of these efforts together.
Yeah, so Fresno is very unique. We're very lucky here and have strong collaborations across sectors. And so whether that's non-governmental agencies providing direct services to victims, or our law enforcement, or even local governance, has really committed to the issue of human trafficking and to making a difference within that. And so when we're looking at the individuals that are directly working with victims of trafficking and survivors of trafficking, we are looking at non-governmental organizations. And so this past week, many of us came together for the Pledge to Stop Trafficking. And so that is a collaborative fund that is held at the Central Valley Community Foundation. We go out on the streets every third Tuesday of January in a pass the boot type of fashion, or Kids Day, to collect funds for this fund at the Community Foundation that all of us have access to. And so it's organizations like ourselves, the Central Valley Against Human Trafficking Project at Fresno EOC, and also the Central Valley Justice Coalition, but it's also Breaking the Chains. They provide direct services to all victims of trafficking as well. It is Beauty for Ashes and Made for Them, and Molly's House, and the Fresno Police Chaplaincy. And we have the Fresno Police Department out there as well. They don't take any funding, but they're there to support us as agencies that are helping support them and their work as well.
And Jessica, tell us about the Central Valley Justice Coalition. What do you do?
Yeah, so we've actually been around almost 10 years now. And in the last 5 years or so, we've really narrowed our focus specifically on the prevention side of this work. And so as we kind of took assessment of our community about 5 years ago, we really identified that if we can get ahead of the problem and reach especially the youth, but really anyone and everyone with education, then we can hopefully stop this before it happens, which, as you can imagine, saves so many things. It saves lives. It saves years and years of services. It saves money. It's just what we believe is the best way to address it for our specific organization. And so thankfully, we work with all other partners, and we do provide some services as well. But what we do is we offer community workshops. We do extended programs for youth, whether that's in a high school, a middle school, a church, group homes. And so we really believe that the more tools we can get into the hands of people to identify it and to prevent it, the better off we'll all be together. So that's what we're all about.
Because I would imagine the process of escaping a human trafficking situation has got to be incredibly difficult.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
It really is world-shattering. When you think about victims of trafficking, their trafficker typically provides all of their basic needs for them. So their housing, food, clothing, protection, anything like that. And when they get taken out of that situation, they have to rebuild themselves from the ground up while overcoming this immense trauma, overcoming barriers, oftentimes as individuals of color, individuals that are overcoming poverty from a very early age, that have suffered childhood abuses. And so it is a lot to overcome. When we first identify victims of trafficking, or they first get taken out of their trafficking situation, what we do is really just address their basic needs first. Food, shelter, water, sleep oftentimes, because we recognize we're not going to get anywhere unless we can identify those needs and we can build upon those.
And how do you even find the victims?
So It can be a multitude of different ways. We get quite a few referrals from law enforcement that identify individuals. We'll get referrals from other nonprofit organizations, from hospitals, from the individuals themselves, that sometimes they're referred by other friends that know that they're in this situation, and they refer them out for help. Or it could be family members calling in suspecting that their child or their loved one is in a trafficking situation and needs help. And so it could be a multitude of different ways. We also have a strong partnership with the National Human Trafficking Hotline, where we're the regional coordinators for the hotline. And anytime somebody calls into the national hotline, they will connect them to us if they're within our region and they need help getting out of their situation. And so we get quite a few referrals through them as well.
You know, I could imagine this must be incredibly emotionally difficult work to engage in. Jessica, maybe you could chime in on how you care for yourself and how you advise other advocates to handle the stress of this work in order to avoid, you know, too much turnover.
Yeah, absolutely. We talk about self-care a lot in our office and with our partners. As Sarah mentioned earlier, I feel extremely fortunate to be a part of really this extended team here in Fresno. Sarah and I and several others, we meet once a month for coffee. In our office, we actually have a self-care policy that we're continually working on to encourage our own staff. And we don't make it, it's funny because we talk about, okay, we don't want to have a policy that makes it like a requirement to where you feel burdened by the idea of self-care. But at the same time, we recognize sometimes we're in this field because we care so deeply about others. So we need to also apply those same principles to ourselves. So a lot of it is a personal journey, I think, having done this for about 10 years, like figuring out when do I need to take a break for myself, you know, not look at my phone, when do I need to exercise, when do I just need to go away for a weekend. But it really does also help to have partnerships in the community to really talk through things from time to time. So yeah, I think there's a variety of things. I think the most important thing is just to continue the conversation about it. And so in our office, we try to come to that conversation, I would say maybe quarterly, just whenever it comes up that we notice, you know, hey, it's been really crazy. It's been really busy. How are you doing? And yeah, it can be as simple as that.
Yeah. So, Sarah, from where you stand, do you see these efforts being, how are they working?
I think that our numbers are telling. We are identifying so many victims of trafficking. We're being up to 1,000 victims now over the past decade is monumental, because those are all individuals that are receiving services, that are receiving help.
And I guess there's no way to know how many more victims are out there.
Right. And this work is hard. We see individuals go back to their trafficker. We see individuals go back into exploitive situations because overcoming the barriers of receiving assistance can be very difficult. And then the additional trauma on top of that can be so hard. So we have to look at it through a lens of, are they making progress for them? And are these individuals making efforts to better their own lives in their perspective, not my perspective? Because what my view of progress is, or what my view of productivity is and healing is, can be very, very different, and letting them define their own goals. And for many individuals, it could be that they come out of their trafficking situation and they couldn't even tell you a goal that they had for themselves. And so even that fact of defining a goal and empowering them to make decisions for themselves, to offer choices, I see that as a success. And so I think when we put it in the framework of the little successes, we're doing good. We're making a difference within that. And when we zoom out and we look at the individuals that we're impacting, we're making a large difference as well. And so we're doing work within this community. We're helping victims, but there's a lot more work to do. And I think that as a community, everyone needs to engage in order to eradicate human trafficking. Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you so much for being here and for talking about this incredibly important issue. We appreciate it.
Mm. Thank you for having us.
Thanks for taking the time for this. Yeah. Thanks.
You're
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. We've just heard how several agencies are working to reduce human trafficking in the Valley. Now we're going to turn to the story of a survivor. I recently spoke with a young woman who asked to be identified only as Hazel. She escaped a life of forced prostitution and is currently getting help from the nonprofit Molly's House, whose founder, Torella McAllister Minor, joined us in the conversation. So, Hazel, I appreciate your willingness to share your story with us. Tell us how you came to be trafficked.
Well, it all started whenever I was like a young teenager. My father had passed away, and I was in and out of foster homes and on the run, and I met this boy. Remind you, he's not an adult. He was a teenager. And it all started by him telling me that he loved me and just telling me stuff that wasn't true and just being there for me whenever I needed someone to be there for me because I was alone. And that's how it all started.
And what happened?
Well, we were on the run. I was on the run. He gave me a place to stay, and I was vulnerable, and I needed a place to stay, and I needed money. So he provided the things that I needed, and eventually he started telling me that, oh, we needed more money. So I started doing stuff for money that I didn't want to do, but I did it because I needed somewhere to stay. And that's the main thing that happened, and that's how it all started.
And how long were you in that situation? How did you manage to escape?
I was in that situation for quite a long time. I managed to escape because I got really sick, and I had to go to the hospital. And when I went to the hospital, that's whenever I got out of the situation, and I got back with my mom, and then I ended up doing good for a little bit, and then I went back out there, and then I finally got caught up, and I went to juvenile hall, and then that's how I got introduced to Molly's House.
You know, Torella, I understand that Hazel's story is pretty common, that it's difficult to get out, and that oftentimes survivors end up going back. Is that the case?
Yes. And it's not always going back. And in fact, it's not going back because they want to and they love the lifestyle. It's going back because they don't see any other option and out of fear.
Hazel, I'd like to come back to you. How are you doing now? I understand you're getting support from Molly's House. Tell us how you're doing.
I'm doing awesome. I'm a straight-A student. I have high honor roll. I'm top 5 in my class. I'm applied for college. I'm being really successful, and I'm really confident in myself. And being with Molly's House has helped me just realize who I am and that I am worth something. And I love myself.
That's incredible to hear. Tell us a little bit about the transition, how you got from where you were to where you are now. What were the kinds of support that helped you get out of that terrible situation?
Just knowing that I do not want to live that life anymore, and just wanting to get my act right, and knowing that this is my only second chance to redo good and live a better life. And trust me, it wasn't easy. But when I first got to the program, I didn't want to do it. My plan was to just stay there for 6 months and then go back to the life because I didn't like the life, the new life that I was in. And I ended up staying and I ended up liking it. And then I ended up wanting the actual change for my life.
What was the hardest part about getting out?
The hardest part was like getting away from my pimp and not being able to manage to take care of myself and not have anyone to be there for me and just not wanting to be alone.
I know this is probably difficult for you to talk about, but I'm just wondering if you can share a little bit more about your relationship with your pimp and how some of the tactics that were used to control you.
He told me that he would provide for my family because my mom wasn't as stable enough. So I was like, oh, okay, that'll help my mom out. And he would also like just feed me lies about how we would have a good life. And he would buy me like everything, like a house and everything. And it was just lies that I just believed.
Tarilla, can you just tell us a little bit briefly about the kind of support you provide to women like Hazel?
We provide residential treatment services where they go through therapy every day, individual and group therapy. They do a curriculum called My Life, My Choice. I think one of the biggest things that makes us a 7-year success is that we really, truly love our girls. And we provide an environment that is nurturing and safe where they feel they can really breathe and not have to fear being found or having to go back to something that they did not want to go back to. The environment we also provide is non-judgmental environment. Once they walk through that door, every one of my staff members and volunteers know that it's a non-judgment zone. Mm-hmm. And so they are children who deserve to have a normal life as any other child that did not have the experience, horrific experience that they had.
Hazel, before we wrap up, I'd just like to hear you discuss how you learned to love yourself after everything that you've been through.
I learned to love myself by just having people believe in me and just knowing that I am worth something and that I am beautiful, because before I did not think any of that. And I also realized that God has a big part of it too.
There are potentially people listening to this conversation who are victims of trafficking. What advice would you have for them? What would you say to them?
You are worth way more than you think you are, and you deserve way more. And you need to get help.
Well, thank you so much for being so brave and for sharing your story. And you certainly are an inspiration for many, many people. So thank you.
Thank you. You're welcome.
If you or someone you know is a victim, contact the National Human Trafficking Hotline at 888-373-7888. And finally, California has moved up its primary election. Instead of June, voters will now cast their ballots in March. And there are other changes for some Valley counties, in part to increase voter turnout. Fresno has adopted the new Voters' Choice Act model, which means voting centers have replaced polling places, and every voter is mailed a ballot. Madera County adopted it in 2018. To explain the transition, FM89's Laura Satsui spoke with Fresno County Clerk and Registrar of Voters Brandy Orth and Rebecca Martinez, Clerk and Registrar of Voters in Madera County.
Brandy, I want to start with you, since Fresno County is newly adopting the Voters' Choice Act model. In your mind, what is the biggest change for voters to get used to here?
Well, I think there are a lot of different changes, but one of them is that everyone will automatically receive a ballot in the mail. In Fresno County, over 65% of people vote by mail anyway.
Oh.
And so their life really isn't going to change a whole lot, but the other folks will receive a ballot to their home, and they'll go out on February 3rd.
So that means that those people who haven't opted in, they could either return that ballot or still show up to a polling center and cast it in person if they'd like?
Exactly. So we have a little bit different terminology. So we call them vote centers. But you're right. You may receive all the services that you would have received if you had come to my downtown office.
And Rebecca, since Madera already experienced these initial growing pains, I suppose you would call them, in the 2018 election, for your county, what was maybe the biggest change for voters to get used to, if anything?
Probably the biggest would have been that you still have that percentage of voters that were not already receiving their ballot in the mail, or those people who are now getting their ballot in the mail. And that is significant, because you have people that are not familiar with that process, don't know what to do with a ballot that comes to them in the mail. I had many, many people who came into the vote center and they thought that ballot that we sent them was their practice. And so they were there to get another ballot issued to them. So that was big. And then realizing that we no longer had 40 locations for people to vote at, we had 6.
Right. So instead of 40 polling places by precinct, it was just 6 vote centers for Madera.
Correct.
Gotcha. And for those in Fresno who might be asking why change things at all, Brandy, what would you tell them in Fresno?
Well, again, it was kind of a combination of both things. Replacing the voting equipment and having to realize a savings of $1.5 million was a substantial part of the decision. The other is that we believe that the Voters' Choice Act really provides more flexibility for voters. The other thing that we need to make sure voters know is that the vote centers are open for multiple days. You don't have to go just one day anymore. In Fresno County, we will have 43 that are open 3 days before the election and election day. So Saturday, Sunday, Monday, and then election day. I also have 10 that are open for the full 11 days, meaning 2 weekends and the middle week. So now we have expanded voting from 1 day and 13 hours to multiple days and 93 hours to vote. It's pretty substantial.
So the hope I'm hearing is that more people take advantage of that, more access to voting. And so, Rebecca, do you know how much voter turnout did change with the 2018 election in Madera?
So if I compared it to 2014, which was a like election.
Another midterm sort of not presidential election.
Correct, correct. So we went up 8% in June of 18 from June of 14. And then in the general in November of 18, we'd gone up 16% from the November in 2014.
So definitely more
so
voter
it did increase. Did the Voters' Choice Act have anything to do with it? We don't know. We don't know if there were issues. I know that there was more action going on out in the community trying to get people to vote, especially with voter registration up and through Election Day and being able to vote on that same day. That, of course, increased some of the turnout. So we don't know yet. I think it's going to take a few cycles before we can truly say that the Voters' Choice Act is what truly brought up the increased turnout.
And Rebecca, if you could go back in time, what advice might you either give yourself before Voters' Choice Act was implemented, or in turn, what advice would you give, you know, Brandy in Fresno County as they do this right now?
If I had to go back, I would prepare for really long lines. So in Madera, they're not used to lines. We just, you know, we didn't have lines to speak of. And so the lines were huge. And
was that on election day or even the day?
It was on election day because people didn't take advantage of the days prior to where you had the vote centers open on the 2 weekends.
So maybe that's the advice to give is if you can potentially.
And that's our push now with our voters. And that is election day is not just one day. We're saying vote early. But we're not necessarily saying that you need to put your ballot in the mail the day after you receive the ballot, but at least get your ballot in those days prior to Election Day when the vote centers open. Because we provide the postage now. You can put it in a drop box throughout county. You can go to the vote center and drop it off. So you have several options now that you didn't used to have.
And I want to clarify, these changes are only affecting voters in Fresno and Madera counties. So for listeners, if you're a resident of Tulare, Kern, Kings, you still have to opt in to vote by mail or go to your precinct polling place. But for you, Brandy and Rebecca, do you believe this will become the norm for elections in, say, 20 years? Do you think more counties will continue to adopt it? Brandy, how about you start?
I think it's going to be way sooner than that. So right now, Rebecca was one of the pioneers of Voters' Choice Act, and she was one of 5 counties that went in 2018. Right now, in 2020, there are 15 counties in the state, and because LA County is one of them, over half of the electorate in California will be voting under this model. So I think you're already kind of seeing that trend. And what do you think, Rebecca?
I think that at sometime in the future, it's going to be mandated for all the counties to move forward. The difficulty is whether or not you have a voting system that will accommodate being able to check in voters electronically, and whether or not you have a voting system that will accommodate it. And like Brandy, we had an old voting system that I purchased in 1990. And so it was quite old and antiquated. And I knew that I couldn't move forward with the Voters' Choice Act unless I purchased a new voting system. So we rolled out a new voting system, and we also rolled out a new voting model in 2018. And so it's a huge undertaking, and it's a lot for voters to embrace.
Well, and people sometimes react strongly to change, but I feel that this is maybe a passive one. You know, you could just wait and receive your ballot in the mail. And so, or you could go and the days before skip the lines and vote in person at a voting center. But I guess as a last thought to our listeners, ultimately, for both of you, what do you want people to know? Do they need to do anything differently, Brandy, in Fresno County?
Well, I think in all of the voters in the entire state, the most important thing right now is to go check your voter registration online. Make sure that you're listed at the right address that you live at. Make sure you have listed at the party that you want the ballot for. That's one big thing about this particular election. It is a party ballot. So we have 10 versions of the ballot out there across California, and there are some unusual rules about some of them, but that's probably the biggest thing for this particular kind of election is, you know, do your homework a little bit ahead of time. We want to help you. We want to get you the right ballot, but you have to communicate with us. Call us at for Fresno County at 600-VOTE, or visit our website. You'll find a lot of great stuff on there. It's votefresnocounty.com, and we're here to help you.
All right, and Rebecca, what about you? What do you need people, voters, to know in Madera County?
They need to know that the ballot that we've sent them is the official ballot. If you come to a vote center to get a ballot, it will be exactly the same. They should know before Election Day what their party, political party affiliation is, what they're registered with. And if they're not registered with a party, if they are registered as a nonpartisan, they need to make contact with our office and find out what they need to do to change to, I believe it's a Democrat, Libertarian, and American Independent. You can call us or send us an email and let us know that you want to vote one of those ballots, one of those parties' ballot, and we'll send it out. If you want to vote Green, Peace and Freedom, or Republican, you'll have to re-register to vote. And you can do that online at votemadera.com. And also to just get out and vote your ballot early.
Well, thank you both so much. We've been speaking to Brandy Orth and Rebecca Martinez, county clerks and registrars of voters for Fresno and Madera counties, respectively, about the changes to voting in those counties, because both are now following the Voters' Choice Act model. If you want more information, as they mentioned, or if you have specific questions about voting, you can find it on their respective websites. Thank you both for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for having me.
And that's today's Valley Edition. You could hear all this and more on our website, kvpr.org. You can also download the podcast and find us on Twitter and Facebook. We've got an app. It's called KVPR. The show is produced by our news team, including Alice Daniel, Carrie Klein, and Laura Satsui. Technical support from Marv Allen and Don Weaver. I'm your host, Kathleen Schock. This has been Valley Edition. Thanks for listening.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, advancing healthcare that works for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.